and HB 142 business practice regulations. For everybody in the audience, I will take the testimony on 178 first. Hopefully it will not be too long, and therefore we're going to move on to House Bill 142. Still waiting word. We're endeavoring to hook up with Mr. John McCabe, legal counsel of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Law, to Chicago. To my knowledge, we haven't hooked up on teleconferences yet. But rather than to wait any further, I'd like to go ahead and proceed with testimony on House Bill 178. And first, we also have online for people on 178, Mr. Art Peterson and Juneau. Art, are you in Juneau, sir?
Yes, I'm here and ready. Thank you.
Very good. I think I'd like to start out and take the testimony in the following order. Have Mr. Jerry Weaver of the Alaska Bankers Association, followed by Mr. Kurtz and then Mr. Peterson, if you have any comments. So, Mr. Weaver, sir.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. May I sit here?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Weaver. I'm a Senior Vice President and Commercial Loan Manager for the National Bank of Alaska, and I'm also Secretary Treasurer for the Alaska Bankers Association. The Alaska Bankers Association represents all of the banks in Alaska. That's 8 commercial banks, 1 savings and loan, and 1 mutual savings bank. The banking industry through the Alaska Bankers Association and through other banking associations nationwide have been working for some years at making small technical revisions in the Uniform Commercial Code and working with the Uniform Code Commissioners who will be testifying behind me. HB 178, which would revise letters of credit, is just one of those technical steps along the way. Letters of credit basically are a fairly sophisticated instrument used primarily in foreign trade, and have some very technical steps in which this Bill 178 makes some slight revisions that would probably be good after many years of practice with letters of credit. Therefore, the Alaska Bankers Association, and we've also presented you with a letter from the National Bank of Alaska, heartily endorsed the bill. The amendments that have been made or have been proposed, basically we believe would deviate from the UCC's common approach to trying to tie all 52 of the various UCC districts together. And therefore, because this would present some problems and certainly have Alaska stand out as being different in its code and how it approaches letters of credit, we recommend that the proposed amendments be removed from 178 as it's presented. Yes, that's about the extent of my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Appreciate that, Mr. Weaver. Are there any questions, Mr. Weaver? Mr. Weaver, I have I think it would be helpful for the committee if you could give us a little elementary banking 101 and how the letters of credit work, and then the issue that revolve around the amendments as it relates to the float period and so forth. Could you just very briefly describe how the mechanics of this and what impact the float issue have?
This bill doesn't discuss float at all. It's in that paragraph that's in there, and Representative Ryan and I discussed this just about an hour ago at some length. Basically, what it's talking is letters of credit are document issues. Basically, in very essence terms, it's a guarantee of a credit grantor or someone you know, a bank usually, because you can verify their credit ratings and their financial statements fairly easy worldwide, and that's why banks typically wind up as issuers of letter of credits. The transactions are document issues. When a letter of credit is issued, basically it has a number of other documents that will go with it when it's presented for payment. An example we were using earlier would consist, let's say, a load of forest products coming out of here, a load of round logs. If they were to go, typically what would be with them, of course, would be an invoice billing for the amount of the logs. If one of our, let's assume a Native Corporation, were shipping logs overseas to Japan, Taiwan, someplace like this. A bill of lading, which is the negotiable instrument you have to have to get the logs off the ship and take title to them. Usually some sort of scaling permit or so forth that would rate the quality and the quantity of material that's in there, how many board feet and so forth. This would be done by an independent agent who would have been verified by both the buyer and seller. Usually these are rated much like an appraiser or something of this nature. And probably then the insurance that would say, okay, if something happens to the ship after it leaves and so forth, who gets paid on what terms if for some reason the logs never make the destination. Those documents are put with the letter of credit, and the letter of credit outlines which documents are required and so forth and sent to the beneficiary's bank on the other side who takes a look at the documents, matches them to the letter of credit, and when they totally match up, then they authorize payment. The funds then are wire transferred once all of the documents are approved and the transaction happens. Meantime, the ship hopefully sailing across the Pacific on its way to deliver the actual cargo. This happens with a good many of the natural resources that Alaska exports. The reason the time period is in there is quite frequently, for whatever reason, the documents may not exactly match up. And this just allows a uniform time period for the parties to try, the banks in this case, to try and make sure those documents match and that the buyer and seller are actually getting the transaction that they really wanted instead of just dealing with the documents as they are. For instance, the log scale may not quite match the shipment that was called for in the letter of credit, and it probably allows for partial shipments and so forth in there. Or the timing might be off, or part of the product may have been damaged and loading, or you could come up with all kinds of circumstances. And in the time period that's allowed in this UCC revisions is basically just for that purpose. And it doesn't affect money because the money isn't going to be transferred until the actual letter of credit is approved, and then the funds are wired. And usually these are large dollar transactions with a fairly small number of players.
Then if there's a wire transfer of funds, that comes under the those regulations that cover that, not necessarily letters of credit. As far as the payment of the actual funds from one party to another, or the bank clearing them, like sometimes you have a clearing period, don't you, from the...
Well, a bank wire funds transfers, of course, are absolute. Basically, the wire is just knowledge that says, hey, move the money from account A to account B.
Okay.
And that's all the wire, and usually there's a code and everything else so that the money isn't mistransferred. But at that point, it's certain funds. And certainly the players we're talking about on any of the kind of transactions I'm talking about, you know, aren't going to stand for much float. You know, Mitsui and the Bank of Tokyo, Bank Taipei, they want immediate and prompt payment. And that's exactly what occurs in this case. But basically, the document period we're talking about has to do with these documents. Letters of credit are all about documents.
But there wouldn't, for example, in your example of the log export, there wouldn't be any actual transfer of funds until the receipt of those logs and they were satisfied that that's what they wanted and then they transferred?
No. It would be in this case, Mr. Chairman, it's a document. It would relate solely to the documents, not to the logs. The logs are out in the middle of the Pacific, and the payment would match the scale report's in here, the insurance is here, the bill of lading's here, and an invoice for $1,231,000, which was the amount that's required. And there's usually a draft, the equivalent of a demand check that says pay this. Then once they check those off to the letter of credit, and the letter of credit basically issued by, let's say in this case, the National, I guess it's going to be Bank of Tokyo in this case, is we will pay $1,231,000 when we receive each of these documents. Now, if for some reason there were an error in one of those documents, it doesn't quite match the buyer's needs. Gee, it isn't $1,231,000, it's only $1,014,000. It isn't... It wasn't quite the quantity of spruce they threw a little pine in. And that's simply because probably the buyer and the seller had been negotiating on the phone or via teletype, and that's what they agreed to do. Now the documents are a little different, so the two banks, so Bank of Tokyo is going to wire NBA and say, gee, when you issued this letter of credit, or we would be wiring them. I keep getting this transaction backwards. And say, gee, the transaction's a little different. This is what occurred. Does your buyer approve? They would then call the buyer. The buyer would say, sure. And as soon as the buyer does, then the funds are wired. And that's a direct transfer of money.
So if there's any real float time, it would be a delay in payment after the receipt of the letter of credit, but during that period of making sure that everything was in order there. So in case there is any accusations about that. How do you handle that if there is a problem and you think everything's in order and you're still not releasing the funds?
The UCC, and that's what this bill spells out quite clearly as to how, which committee, and Mr. Kurtz hopefully will talk about that, is going to set up how they arbitrate the distribution. And that's basically what this bill's all about. What if there are problems and the payer doesn't want to pay? And it's a very close-knit little club, actually, worldwide. And you won't be playing very long if you don't honor, without some really legitimate complaint as to why you shouldn't make the payment, because the merchandise is already gone.
And for the committee, just generally, if you happen to know, what level of commerce does the state of Alaska have in terms of utilizing letters of credit? What's the scope of that? Are we talking $1 billion, or what are we talking about?
Oh, it's probably not that much. As trade gets established, quite frequently the accounts, and the buyer and the seller get to know each other, they frequently go to open account. And with many of the big trading companies, that's in fact what occurs. Right now, we checked just before we left, the National Bank of Alaska has about $16 million outstanding on letters of credit, to give you some idea right now. Trade, my guess, in Alaska, probably doesn't exceed a couple hundred million dollars a year in using letters of credit.
You say 16 or 60?
16. 16 million is what we have outstanding right now that has not been drawn at any given moment. Now, if you go to peak time during, and that would be fishing season, because a lot of the fish orders go out this way. Those are, remember I mentioned the log scaler? And as you'll remember, in many of the fishing plants, the Japanese trading companies bring their own employees over to grade the product right on the spot. And what they're preparing are the documents that will go with that letter of credit that says, yes, we got what we bought. There were so many silvers, this fresh, this caught. And I, who am, your employee, kind of say that that's exactly what went on that ship in that container. And then once those documents get there, and they will far beat the ship. The ship may take 5 days to make the trip. The documents are going to do it in a day. Then they will wire payment.
Is that right?
Just a couple questions. I talked to you and I told the chairman that if I feel that my concerns were perhaps can be satisfied, that I have to withdraw the. Say, for instance, that I broker a deal, not to coal or fish, lumber, petroleum products, refined or otherwise, and I want the letter of credit assigned to another person because I'm going to use that assigned to settle a previous debt. Is there going to be a problem under here?
Fortunately, I brought with me, now we're starting to get just enough technical that I'd like to consult or ask.
Please.
Yes. Melody, would you, this is Melody Little, who is a letter of credit officer with the National Bank of Alaska. For a good long time, Melody, this is exactly what she does.
For the record, Melody, could you identify yourself?
My name's Melody Little, and I work with National Bank of Alaska in the International Department.
I don't mean to get crosswise, but I want to be assured that somebody isn't sitting on somebody's money, either keeping afloat and or offering a banker's acceptance in lieu of the actual cash that is deliverable. People being what they are, when an opportunity arises for a fellow to make a buck, from time to time people take advantage of those opportunities. A lot of people who are dealing in these kind of transactions are hung out, and time on money, time value of money is very important, and sitting 7 days on someone's wire transfer that's already been made can be the difference in the profit in the transaction. that the person has tied up. And so, in effect, if the bank does hold them up 7 days, that particular amount of money would be what the profit would be, and all that work was done for nothing. And I want to ensure that this particular piece of legislation, the way I read it, it looked like it was an opportunity for that to happen. And if you can convince me that I'm wrong, I'd be more than happy to say, fine, let's go.
Okay, so are we asking about the 7 days at this point or the assignment?
Well, let's say, for instance, I want to assign this letter of credit to another party to satisfy some business arrangement I have. Is there going to be any problem, I should say?
Okay, well, when you're talking about an assignment, we're talking about the assignment of proceeds. We're not talking about the assignment of the performance. So in that measure, we wouldn't consider it an assignment. We would consider it a transfer. At that point, what you could do is you would transfer a portion of your letter of credit, whatever amount the actual sale is between the broker and the actual supplier. The supplier would then prepare the documentation, would then give it to the person that's brokering it. They then would give it to their bank to look at for negotiating. And at that point in time, the negotiating bank would compare the documentation. And if everything was in compliance, they would send them to the issuing bank. The issuing bank then looks at the documentation and determines whether they are going to pay and they're obligated to pay. If there are any discrepancies in those documents, then what the issuing bank does is notifies the broker and tells, or the broker's bank, and tells them that there is a problem, and then they try to resolve the situation at that point. As to delay in payment, it's only going to be due to dispute of the document. It's not going to be the actual payment of the sale.
It will not take place before the dispute is settled.
Right.
A lot of times in negotiating contracts with people, you demand a non-revocable, assignable letter of credit, a number of numerous conditions upon the letter of credit, revolving, so on and so forth, so that these transactions can be continued over a period of time. For instance, I have X amount metric tons that we delivered in shipments of X amount, and so the letter of credit has to be revolving each time the shipment is made, a certain amount of money will be transferred to take care of and so forth. And these are, I want to ensure that flexibility is going to be there and that there's not going to be a disruption on the payment, because otherwise it would be a very interesting business to find a reason why we have received the money and upheld it by offering you a banker's acceptance that we'll take the risk for a point and a half or whatever. There are times when those things are, people want to take advantage of that. They're willing to pay the fee to get the money now so they can go on and do something else. But I don't want this to be an opportunity where that would happen, because we're talking about a lot of money when we start dealing in large commodities.
I believe what you're referring to, again, is that seven-day period. What the seven-day period is basically saying is that the issuing bank, once they receive those documents, they have to set priority in their workflow. So it's allowing, that 7 days is allowing them to prioritize it into their work, giving them maybe a 1 or 2 days before they even have a chance to look at the documents. And then if there are problems, the bank usually tries to go to the actual person that owes the money and tries to resolve the situation before they decline their payment. And I think that that's why the seven-day period is given rather than a three-day period. It's just to allow the resolution before declining payment.
We're talking about from the seller's point of view. I get all my stuff together and I send it over. What happens on the other end when the buyer declines the shipment or says the shipment isn't as so forth and refuses to forward? What period of time have we got on that end?
Well, actually, the buyer doesn't even have a chance to look at the goods before they get them. The reason that is usually in a letter of credit, the bill of lading is consigned either to the bank or to the order of shipper and then blank endorsed. What that does is it makes the bill of lading negotiable, and whoever holds it is the only one that can pick up the goods.
Yeah, a lot of credit is negotiable, too, but people are dealing with Nigeria and other places, and India, and a lot of people stop dealing with it because of the circumstances described. Once the goods get there, payment is not forthcoming.
Again, it goes back to relying on the bank that's issuing it. You want to review the financial condition of that bank and making sure that they're honoring what they've written out, and authenticating the letter of credit is another thing. Making sure that the individuals that sign it and have issued it are definitely those that are empowered to do so for the bank.
I'm just trying to err on the side of caution. I don't want to allow opportunities here for people. I envision a lot of this happening in Alaska. Mr. Weaver's told me we don't have that volume, but I'm hoping in the future that we have a big volume of international trade. We have consumers markets throughout the Pacific Rim. I want to see that that this thing is not going to slow something down. We facilitate this trade.
And again, I believe that the 7 days, I don't think that every bank, waits for 7 days before them to look at the documents. I think it's just they're wanting to allow the prioritizing of it, and if there are problems, to resolve it before denying payment.
The AG talks about the reasonable time. Have you seen this letter from the chairman of the AG's office? They talk in here about the institution finding a discrepancy in the first day, but waiting until the end to bring it to the person's attention for it to be cured. Is there, here, perhaps I need to take a look at this.
Representative Ryan, while she's reading the letter, perhaps I could make one comment. As you had mentioned regarding the shipment, going back to what I said earlier, a letter of credit's involved in an issue of documents, not actually the shipment. The letter of credit will be paid if the documents are correct, even if the shipment's not. As I've mentioned to you, let's say a load of bananas and they all rot it. That becomes an insurance claim, but it has nothing to do with these documents and this letter of credit issue. If the documents are there and they're certain, that letter of credit's an enforceable document. And, of course, because you're dealing with two banks who have very strong reputations on the line, in most cases, aside from Nigeria, they're going to be very, very careful how they treat that transaction, because in most cases, both banks have loans also to the various parties involved, the loan to harvest the timber that's going to be paid from it, and the loan to make the purchase acquisition so it can be resold in the foreign market.
How does this 7-day period that we just discussed, how does that compare with other ports or other, say, our competition, L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, or other ports? Is that a common practice?
Uniform standard. It's going to be the same in all 52 districts. Exactly the same. It'll be worldwide, and the Europeans would do exactly the same. 7 days. Clean up the little details and make sure the documents are right. That way, everybody gets paid.
I understand.
And this system works actually very, very well.
Yeah, I did work that on. Just for the record.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Weaver, and ma'am, I really appreciate you coming here and taking your time from your busy schedule. It was very helpful for this committee to devote the time you have to make sure that some of these questions are resolved.
Thank you, and we stand by to assist in any way we can.
Thank you very much, sir. Next, I'd like to hear from Mr. Kurtz, please. Mr. Kurtz, if you have any further to add very briefly, we be greatly heard. Appreciate it, and we appreciate your testimony in past hearings on this bill.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be very brief because you have listened to me enough already. I'd like to just respond to one thing that was raised, and that concerns a seven-day period. The period really isn't 7 days. 5-0108 says that an issuer has a reasonable time after presentation, but not beyond the end of the seventh business day. And it's drawn that way with reasonable time first, because there are a lot of transactions where the banks don't need 7 days to process these things. And one of the official comments that the drafters of this code mentioned was that a mining transaction where you're just dealing with mining output is a good example of somewhere where 7 days usually isn't needed. So reasonable can always be stretched, but at least that section puts some additional pressure on banks, and my experience has been that most banks do respond faster than 7 days in these situations. With a mine run standby letter of credit, typically your time would be less than 7 days. Most of the problems in this area come up where documents don't fit. The documents that are received don't fit the letters of credit. And I think I indicated before, litigation over this area has been very scarce. I'm not aware of any in Alaska in the 30 years of practice law up here. And a lot of it's because the issuing bank and the banks on the other end tend to push very hard to work these things out. They don't want to get into court. That's all I have to add. But I'm happy to answer any questions or talk with anybody later on if there are further.
Very good, Mr. Kurtz. My secretary reminds me that I failed to ask you for your identifying your affiliation.
I'm sorry.
No, it's my fault, sir. Please do so.
I'm officially L.S. Kurtz, Jr., known as Jerry. I'm a member of the Uniform Law Commission, appointed several governors back, I think, by Governor Cooper, but I've been retained by the subsequent ones. I'm one of the Alaska representatives that goes to the Uniform Law Conference every year to review legislation of all types that's proposed by the conference. And I'm retired. I'm not representing banks or anybody else for the most part these days, and I've had a lot of experience working on both sides of the fence. I think I've more often represented parties other than banks in dealing with letters of credit. Banks.
Very good, sir. So if this Representative Ryan gets in any difficulties in his business activities wearing his other hat, he could call on you to help straighten out the mess.
As long as I have some liability insurance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have online Mr. Art Peterson. Art, we're moving along pretty quick here. Is there anything you'd like to add today?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if you could identify yourself. Please.
Yes, this is Art Peterson. I'm an attorney in private practice in Juneau. I'm also one of Alaska's Uniform Law Commissioners. To follow Jerry Kurtz's pattern, appointed even more governors back and reappointed by successive ones. I was first appointed in 1975. On the questions raised regarding House Bill 178, I would just really like to emphasize that the amendments proposed by Representative Ryan would really do some damage to the bill, certainly do some damage to uniformity. One of the main features of the Uniform Commercial Code is that it has been adopted in all United States jurisdictions with the partial exception of Louisiana, which is different in a number of respects from all of the other states and possessions of the United States. And in addition, the UCC has set an international standard, and many of its provisions coincide with the international standards of practice. for Alaska to adopt some of these unique provisions in Representative Ryan's set of amendments would really put Alaska in a bad situation for, in this instance, doing letters of credit business. Jerry Weaver commented on the amount that his bank does in a typical year in this field, and estimated that maybe there were a couple hundred million statewide involving the other banks in Alaska. One figure that I've had is that in the United States as a whole, it's a $200 billion industry, and Alaska certainly doesn't want to be viewed as off on its own little twig. It's not even much of a limb to stand on, but I don't think we'd want to do that. And certainly the Uniform Law Commissioners would oppose those amendments. It's my understanding, and I don't want to try to speak for the Department of Law, but it's my understanding that the Department of Law also opposes them. There was a letter submitted to you, Mr. Chairman, last spring by Doug Lottridge, a former Assistant Attorney General, that made comments along that line, and I believe also that the Department of Commerce Division of Banking does not support those amendments. Again, I want to say that I cannot speak for them. I've not been authorized to speak for them, but that is my impression. And I would encourage your committee to report the bill out, do pass, as introduced and without the Ryan amendments. And if you would like, I would be happy to describe something of the years-long process, I mean, not in great detail, but something of the process that acts go through before they get to the promulgation stage by the National Conference. If that would be helpful, I'd be happy to do so, but I can, in one sentence, simply assure the committee that it is a long process with many different segments of the business community and the legal community involved in that. There are heated debates in committee, there are heated debates on the floor, and just about all points of view are thrashed through, and we then finally go to an official promulgation. In this instance, it's also been blessed by the American Law Institute and the American Bar Association and a long list of other national organizations. So again, I thank you for your time and urge the committee to report the bill out, do pass, without the Ryan amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. I think we've had sufficient testimony on this to date. Let me just double-check and see if Mr. McCabe has come online. I don't believe so. Just double-check. Before we close out the hearing, Representative Ryan does have a question to Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson, I have stated that if I had the assurance that seems to have been given to me here, that my concern would be who gets to keep the money for what period of time is not an issue, right? You have to withdraw those amendments. The concern I have is that it's one occurrence, and I think that what I've so far I don't have any problems. As a further thing, I would if you could give me a call in the future, there's another law I'd like to talk to.
Very good. Well,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Pierce, go ahead.
Yes. I don't know whether it was the machine or what, but a lot of what Representative Ryan just said was blipped. Your assistant is looking at me somewhat quizzically, too, because she couldn't hear it either. It was like one of those comedy routines where every fifth word is blipped out or something. But if I get the gist of what Representative Ryan was saying, and I think he said he was asking me a question, but I didn't get the question mark at the end because it just sort of went blank. here. He's concerned about the time period that both Jerry Weaver and Jerry Kurtz have addressed, and I can't do certainly as good a job as they, but let me just emphasize what Jerry Kurtz was saying, that it is a reasonable time or 7 days, so that if a reasonable time is 1 day, that's the amount of time that is all that's allowed, and that's the international standard. If a reasonable time is 6 days, it's 6 days. If a reasonable time is 82 days, well, they're still stuck with seven. So the bill looks like it's written about as tightly as can be, while recognizing all of the procedures involved and all of the international practice that we're trying to address here. Representative Bryan, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but if not, try again.
I think my concerns have been addressed. Do you hear me now? Well,
no.
Mr. Peterson?
We got a bum mic or something.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Representative Ryan said he thinks that his concerns have been addressed, and he's going to call you about another issue on another bill, the UCC bill.
Oh.
If that's okay.
Okay, sure. That'll be fine.
Very good. With that, and given the statement of Representative Ryan, with that, public hearing is closed on House Bill 178. It will be the chairman's intention to bring this bill up for final movement in the committee upon the reconvening of the committee in regular session. And I'd like to thank everybody that came today and has worked diligently with this committee in three different hearings on this. And I am pleased to be able to report this out and move it to hopefully... we will be moving it to the floor early in January. Well, thank you very much. With that, I'd like to go on to House Bill 142. If the Secretary could... thank you very much. Provide me with the witness. Okay. Okay, we're changing the tape, too. Please let us know. With that, in just one moment, did you want to make any opening comments, Representative?
Probably the opening comment I should make is that if...
Hold on.
Okay.
We're not on the record yet.
Okay.
Okay, let's... wait a minute. Where's Joe? Catch them up. Okay, back in order. I'd like to open the hearing for House Bill 142. The last hearing on House Bill 142 was May 5th, 1997, during the legislative session. This will be our second hearing. So there are a number of members of the public that expressed an interest in testifying on that bill. And with that, we do have on teleconference from the great city of South.net. The esteemed Representative Gary Davis. Representative Davis, you'd like to make a comment, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last hearing we had on House Bill 142 and almost all of the hearings, the debate centered around the sections relating to the selling of new and used motor vehicles and some of the disclosures required to minimize fraudulent sales if there's been been damage to the vehicle or if there are known problems with the vehicle. That those sections include, I believe, about the first five pages of the legislation. The rest of the bill, which is rather lengthy, has had little debate and are covering some loose ends that the Attorney General's office and specifically Mr. David Schwartz, who deals specifically with consumer affairs issues, is requesting being clarified in statute. There are sections that he has found problems with in dealing with cases through his office, and I would assume that Mr. Schwartz is probably available, and possibly Ms. Crystal Smith too from the Attorney General's office. This legislation came to me at their request, and some of the inclusions seemed rather quite practical and in need of clarification in statute. And as I indicated, the dealing with the used new and used motor vehicles has had the most discussion and the most input and also the most objections. The Automobile Association has been rather vocal in objecting to anything coming down on them any harder with any more requirements of disclosure. And I believe even your last committee meeting heard testimony from them. So if I would certainly prefer to have Mr. Schwartz and Ms. Smith, I don't know what's been done either by yourself, Mr. Chairman, or the Attorney General's office in meeting with the automobile salesman and seeing if you could come to some agreement, either simplification or clarification in the existing language. So I would certainly prefer to have Mr. Schwartz or Ms. Smith detail and go into any more information on the specific legislation before you.
Very good. Mr. Schwartz has signed up here and is in attendance. And also a number of people from the Automobile Dealers Association. Therefore, what I'd like to do, I noticed a number of you have signed up and said if yes requested, but I think I'd like to go ahead and take as much testimony as the folks in the audience would like to provide. In response to Representative Davis's question, this committee or the chairman has not had any direct dealings with anybody from the industry per se, other than to have meetings that we had last spring and June with a number of your representatives, where I indicated that I would have a committee hearing here in Anchorage to allow you to vent your spleen, and this is it. And I'm glad to see we have a pretty fair turnout here, and so I would, if you're reluctant to testify, please don't be. And I think that as Representative Davis has indicated, he's willing to do some things with this particular bill, and one thing that I've had some discussion with is the potentiality of either of even spinning out a separate piece of legislation that might be more appropriate to deal with. So there's several different methods that we could, that we would be happy to look at. So frankly, we are open on the subject and more than willing to take your testimony and input today. And with that, I'd like to continue the public hearing. Yes, Representative Godfrey.
If I could just tell you, I wasn't at the hearing in June that I recall. And maybe some of these questions were asked, but I would just like to throw it open with a few questions that I would like cleared up, maybe the testimony, rather than have to ask each one. And one of them, what if a car is in midterm and has an inspection, you know, a current inspection?
Midterm, what do you mean?
Midterm of the year of inspection has passed within the last 3-4 months and comes up for renewal. I don't know if this is pertinent or anything, and doesn't pass at renewal. I mean, who's at fault in something like that? I mean,
you're talking about the IM test.
The IM test is what I'm talking about. And I was wondering why would a dealer have to, sometimes I think a car dealer maybe have to take vehicles in for trade that really is just part of the deal to make the financing work out, that has very little value to the dealer, and it's expensive to determine sometimes just exactly if the car has been wrecked or if it's had problems or anything. Why wouldn't just a simple disclosure that there's no guarantee or warranty or anything that goes? I think a lot of situations in business, there's no implied warranty goes with this, and I just hope that some people will testify to this. And I was wondering how many vehicles, if there's somebody got a handle on the number of vehicles, used vehicles rather, that are sold from a dealership versus private sector. You know, there's a lot of, driving down the road, see a lot of signs, cars for sales, go out to Costco or any place like that on any weekend. And I was just wondering if anybody's got a handle on that. I think even at Sam's Club, there's a place where you can rent a space and sell your car, and I believe that may be probably pretty much private sector thing, and the guy's just renting the space, and that's pretty much buyer beware. And so these are some areas that I would like, I'd hope anybody that have answers to these type of questions could answer. And I got a notice today, or a call today. They couldn't make it here, so we're not going to deal with this, I don't think, final today, but that some people had some comments, some dealers, that they would like to comment on this bill. So anyway, with them three or four areas that I'm concerned with, hopefully somebody that testified can address those. Thank you.
Well, with that, I'd like to open up the testimony, and for those people coming forward, please identify yourself, your names and affiliations. And we have Emery Shelley. He didn't indicate whether you wanted to testify or not.
Well, I'd like to reserve my speech at this time.
Is there a particular representative from the Alaska Auto Dealers that wants to start out the testimony, Mr. Morrison?
Or? Yeah, maybe again.
Yes, if you would, please.
Well, it's easiest up here with microphones.
Yes, it is. And please identify yourself and your affiliation, sir.
I'm Rick Morrison, Richard Morrison. I'm the owner of Terra Volkswagen Saturn of Anchorage, former president of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, and now one of the board members.
Thank you for coming here today.
It's really hard for me to know where to begin on this. The overall difficulty I see in this particular bill is that it combines some issues that are very complex with some issues that are very simple. The automotive issues and disclosure and the IM law are very, very complex, and there's a lot of considerations that need to be made. The issues that had to do with cleaning up some of the bills and the teleconferencing and the rest of that are completely separate, and because of the complexity of the automotive side of it, we wrote a letter to Gary Davis on March 19th that suggested at that particular point that we get together and try to deal with some specifics in the disclosure laws and some of the other laws. And his opening comments, he had made comment that we weren't interested in making any kind of compromise or change, and I don't want to challenge him, but in this letter it states very clearly that we do see some need for some laws and some things that need to be clarified.
Do we have a copy of that? Could you?
I have a copy here. That
you'll provide us later.
Just to clarify that, I think that the automotive dealers are very interested in trying to get a handle on what the playing field is. And one of the difficulties, and I'll address the IM law momentarily, is that several years ago when the IM law went into practice, there was very little information that was provided to the auto dealers. And so most of us found out that we were violating the statutes and reselling of vehicles before we even knew what was going on. So the first thing we did is we had, that was when we were forming our association. We formed the association, we started an educational process, and were able to eliminate most of those complaints, at least most of those complaints from the people who were associated with our particular group that were willing to come in and get the education on it. We represent almost 100% of the new auto dealers in the state. I think we're only missing one or two of the auto dealers in some of the outlying areas. In the independent auto dealers, we represent a major share of a larger group of them. There are some of the smaller ones or some of the ones that do what I call corner sales that are not part of our association. We probably would not welcome them into our association because they don't have a storefront or substantial investment into their facility to build an ongoing business. But the IM problem, I discussed this with the Better Business Bureau not too long ago and asked how many issues they were coming up with on cars with IM difficulties, or cars sold without the IM being done in both here in Fairbanks, which are two areas that had the IM laws. The response was, we used to see a lot of these. We're not seeing very many anymore. And I said, well, can you give me some kind of an idea? The young lady who answered the question for me said, well, I've been here for about 6 or 8 months. Maybe it's 3, maybe it's 5. And that's not very many units. And when you're taking a look at the number of vehicles that are being sold in the state, and I apologize, I don't have that exact number here, but it's a huge number in excess of 78,000 cars a year, and you're talking about 4 or 5 complaints, then I have to question, why are we changing something or enacting a law or trying to enact a law that would affect a lot of people who are concerned about their customers and concerned about doing their business right and regulating them for the 1 or 2 that are not? Let's focus on the 1 or 2 that are not doing it and do something legislation that goes after this. And I believe that under the current state law, our trade practice, that there is the issues in order to be able to deal with that currently on the books. The other issue that came up is you asked the question about how many transactions were happening in the state. Well, in the state, it's pretty well aligns with national statistics that about 45% of the vehicles sold in the area or in the state are sold by automotive dealers.
Used.
And that the balance of used vehicles is sold by private individuals. And the difficulty that we see, and even discussing with the folks at Better Business Bureau, where they can't address those issues with private individuals, but the bigger issue comes from the private individuals. We have a lot of business people that have an ongoing business that are interested in building their business and keeping it growing, and they're not going to do that by taking advantage of customers or not being straight with customers. And if I'm going to invest in my business and I have a customer that goes away that's unhappy because I didn't take care of an IM certificate or a problem with there, I'm not going to be here very long. Business is too competitive and too difficult. I work very, very hard in my business to maintain a good reputation and to take care of the customers. And if there is a problem, we take care of it. And I think you'll find that in most of the automotive agencies, that's to be true all the way through, with the exception of a few. And I'll go back and say what I said earlier. Let's go after the few that are causing the problem and not regulate the many that are trying to do things right and do things up straightforward. You asked a question about midterm testing. Any car that we bring into inventory, the understanding is we're to do an IM test on it before we show that car. And we try very hard to make sure that happens. If you were to come in and buy a car, that means we register or re-register your car at that time with a fresh certificate. That should give you, if you are at an even year, that should give you a year's coverage. If you're on an odd year, that should give you 2 years coverage in your license. So that should take care of any midterm. There really shouldn't be a midterm on it. Every vehicle that hits our lot is IM prior to it even going on the lot. And I know that the other dealers within our association have attempted to try to do the same thing. And the independent dealers in our association had even gone as far as changing the style of vehicles that they're selling so they're not selling the older, more higher mileage, more tired vehicles so they can avoid those problems. there's a lot of effort going on to protect the consumer just to, in order to do good business and invite those people back in for additional business in the future.
Yes, Representative Cowdery.
Ask him to clarify one point that you just talked about. This is the, you said something about the ones that you bring in, but you take more vehicles in than you sell. Do you, I guess what I'm saying is, do you wholesale things out, vehicles out? How would this law affect anything that you wholesaled or sold at auction? I don't know how you do it. I know there's repo places in town that repo vehicles and then wholesale those off, sometimes to dealers, sometimes to public. I just, if you could comment in that area, I don't want to interrupt your testimony, but I'd like to get that clarified.
In wholesale, you're exactly right. There's a lot of cars that will come in that are in such condition that I wouldn't want to be associated with that car.
Okay.
So we'll have a wholesaler come in, and they'll bid on it, or they'll go to an auction, and they'll bid on it. And I'm not exactly sure how this law would impact that particular thing. I don't believe that this would impact the people who are buying the vehicles as a wholesaler or dealer of wholesale products. I think that it would impact that wholesaler as they got ready to sell them on a retail basis. One of the difficulties you get into on the IM testing is you get somebody who lives in Wasilla, commuting back and forth in town. There's over 3,000 of those people a day that are doing that. They'll need an IM test. So now they're going to sell their car, or they're going to trade their car in. Chances are the greatest selection's in Anchorage. They're going to come into Anchorage to do that. That car has not had an IM test in several years. Now what do you do with that customer and with that car? Kenai is the same way. And as the IM test portion of it, if we're already currently testing our vehicles before we sell them, then I would suggest that we do something to go after those folks that are selling those cars under existing laws to make them do their IM testing or stand up to the laws as they currently exist. I don't think we need an additional law, I guess is what I'm saying in that particular section. But I think to answer your question, under the wholesales, I don't believe the wholesales would be covered as we sell them to another dealer.
By this legislation, this is not impacted. Thank you.
Representative Ryan.
Many years ago, and as a young man, I sold some automobiles. And it was a common practice, I wonder if it's continuing at that time, for most of the productive salesmen would go back through records of people who had previously purchased automobiles from that dealership, and we would call them up on the phone and ask them how their car was, or ready for a new one, or good used one, and so forth. Is it still a common practice in your business?
Yes, it is.
Would this telephone solicitation adversely impact that?
I haven't looked at that. I don't know how to answer that.
Okay. Well, and these consumer protection laws, is it not incumbent upon the buyer to show some due diligence when they say, for instance, I wanted to purchase a used car from you and I came. Could I say that I would like to take this to another place and have it pay for an inspection? Would that be acceptable in your business practice?
It would be encouraged. Not just acceptable. Our particular store offers on any used car that anybody buys from us 3 days right of return. And that means, Mr. Ryan, if you were to buy a car from me today and for any reason, 2.5 days from now, you decided you didn't want that car because of an inspection, because of a problem, because my people didn't care you properly, because you just found out your wife was pregnant and this car no longer fits your needs anymore, you can bring that car back to us. And there's other dealerships within Anchorage now that are doing much of the same thing to make sure that you as a consumer are taken care of. So to answer your question, is it's encouraged. I'm not aware of any of the stores in Anchorage telling anybody they can't have that car inspected. And our feeling has always been if you have inspected, that should identify us from what you're buying. And you can pass all kinds of rules and regulations and legislation, but you can't regulate people from being stupid. If people are going to go in and buy something without investigating it and looking at it, it doesn't matter how many lies you put on the books, you're not going to change things. You've got to get people to be aware and to make them realize they've got to take care of themselves. They've got to know whether the car's going to fit what they need and provide the service that they're looking for.
Well, I may add an old Persian saying I'm familiar with. It says, a buyer needs 100 eyes, a seller needs but one. That's 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, so things haven't changed too much. You must, as a buyer, expect to know what you're doing when you get into a deal. So that's some of these things in here I think are a little far-reaching, and your comments address a lot of my concerns.
Please continue, Mr. Morrison.
Okay. Again, I apologize if I seem like I'm bouncing around on a lot of this, because this issue is so large, it really needs to be separated. On the issue of damage disclosure, we acknowledged and had conversation. I personally discussed this with Mr. Schwartz several times on the new car issue. Right now, under Alaska statute, there is no definition of how much damage or how much repair is acceptable on a new car damage. And right now, if you were to replace a bolt or put a license plate frame on the car, technically by state law, you're supposed to disclose that to the customer. Because it says if there's any alterations from the time that it was new or delivered to you, those should be disclosed. Well, in most states, a process has been adopted at a percentage of the price of the car or a flat dollar amount, that if the car has had $500 or $1,000 damage to it, then that should be disclosed to the individual. But a simple example of a case that can happen is you can have a car that comes in that has a broken front grill. The grill is a plastic item, can be unbolted, a brand new one taken out of the box, put back on the car, bolted back on as a factory original part. State law. Now, by the way, that affects that. Does not affect the value of the car, doesn't affect the resale value, doesn't affect the appearance of the car, and it's all factory parts. By state law today, you must disclose that. But the car was repaired without any way of damage harming the car from what its original shape or condition was, and it doesn't make any difference. Now, if there's a damage in the car that requires a substantial amount of repair, we agree. There needs to be some definition as to what that value is. And we're suggesting that there either be a percentage of the price or a flat dollar amount, much like most of the other states have adopted. The next issue has to do with used cars.
Sportsman, it might be helpful for this committee if your association would be more specific in its recommendation. You prefer to be a percentage, a dollar amount, or something like that. It would be very, very helpful if you could make some written recommendations to any remedial legislation along those lines. Because, I mean, you gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen are the experts in the automobile industry, and this committee is not. We're lawmakers, and we want to make sure we do it the right way, whatever we ultimately do.
Okay. I can understand that, and I agree.
Maybe a dollar amount might work better.
The difficulty with a dollar amount is as things change, what was a serious damage 10 years ago might have been $500. Today, that same damage probably would cost you $2,000 to $3,000. So if you're going to do a flat dollar amount, the difficulty with that is you've got to have some way to update that as time goes by and things change. And that's why the percentage was thrown out as a possibility.
Please continue.
You were just talking about changing a grill or something like that, and I noticed sometimes in some of the things that I've read that they'll advertise some, generally a sports vehicle or something, all the numbers match and this and that, and says the numbers don't match. But can you count, you know what area I'm talking about, so what? I mean, that is what I'm saying. And that would something, if the numbers didn't match, would that have to be required that the engine that came with that vehicle is no longer the tranny or something?
I think you're referring to used vehicles.
Yes.
Yeah, and you can get into some specialty vehicles, Corvette, for example,
yeah.
Where that becomes a collector's bust idea.
I see.
And sometimes that can make a difference. A Porsche. If that has the original engine in it, or somebody's rebuilt that engine, or put something special into it that can make a difference or can alter the value up or down. I'm not sure that that's really what we're referring to in this particular case. That's more of a collector's type comment on it. So I just kind of wrap up in that section on new car. We believe there needs to be something on new cars. We believe it should be defined, because it takes it right now. It's a very gray area, and I think that it would define it for both the consumer and for the auto dealer, so everybody knows the playing ground of what they're working on. Used cars is a very, very complex issue. One of the issues that comes up with that is, if we're going to do a disclosure on used cars, and if 55% of all the used cars sold are sold by private individuals, why would we section out just the automotive dealers? If you'll take a look, more people get taken advantage from other people selling cars than they do from people who are trying to make their business out of selling cars. If you're making your business out of selling cars, then I want your business back. If I don't take care of you, you're not coming back. And there's an old saying that you can shear a sheep once a year, but you can only skin him once. And so with that, the national NADA has been trying for years to lobby to get a national title branding process set up. And they're still pushing towards this. One of the issues we have on used cars, which has gotten a few dealers in trouble, is the insurance company will total a car. They'll sell that car to the best bidder. And John Smith Backyard Auto Repair buys that car, fixes the car poorly, but masks a lot of the repairs through hiding it through undercoating or other things, puts it back out in the market, and they sell it to Jane Doe. Jane Doe then drives it for a little while, and she sells it to her next-door neighbor, Smith Doe, and then so forth. By the time it goes to the third, fourth person, they then take it and trade it in to an auto dealer. The auto dealer then inspects the car. Everything appears to be fine on it, and you put the car out for sale, and now we sell it, and the next person that buys the car then somehow discovers that this car was totaled or had a serious problem. The title had never been marked totaled or branded or reconstructed. And they have a section in the DMV where under the registration or the title, there's a little thing that says REC that you're supposed to understand. That's for reconstruction. We've been doing some work with DMV, and I'm very pleased to tell you that they're working hand-in-hand with us to try to get this problem corrected. If we can get the registration branded so it says reconstructed in big, bold print right across it, you can eliminate a lot of the problems. I believe that there's already a law that says the insurance companies are required, when they total a vehicle, to notify the state, and that the title is supposed to be changed to state that. However, there are a lot of cases that isn't happening. So who's at fault? Is it when it comes back to the dealer? Is it the person who sold the car to his next-door neighbor? Or should it all go all the way back and be handled from the very beginning with the insurance companies? And I think that, again, we have a law there that needs to be followed up on, not necessarily an additional law added to it. And the other problem comes into damage disclosure. Our point on damage in used cars, it's not a matter of whether the car was damaged and repaired. It's a matter of whether the car was repaired properly. If the car was repaired properly, there's no reason for disclosure, because the car was set up to take care of. And you'll find that probably about 90% of all the cars on the market have had some kind of damage. And then how are you going to define the damage? Are you talking about just automotive accident damage? Are you talking about when his shocks wore out because he's driving on a rough road? Is that damage also? And at what point are you going to break the damage on it? And then are we going to start requiring people to keep a log like they do on aircraft, and pass on this log to the next person that's coming there? And the people you're talking about affecting are not just the automotive dealers. You're talking about affecting every consumer that's out there. If we have to make each of you bring your car in, sign a disclosure that tells us anything and everything you've done to your car or the whole time that you've had it, is that something you're going to want to do? And then secondly, is that going to change the value of what you have in your car when you go to resell it? So our point is, the problem isn't whether the car was repaired properly or not. If it's improperly repaired, then there is a problem. Now, they address the issue of whether we are supposed to disclose things that we know are defects on the car. There is already a law under the Fair Trade Act that says if there are known defects, we're supposed to disclose that. And that law has already been used in order to work with other dealers. Now, I would submit to you that most of the automotive dealers you'll see in this room and the automotive dealers within our association are very good about trying to get that straightened out. I think that there's been one case that has been brought with one automotive dealer here in town that 90% of this bill is being trying to be built around that one case. And I would suggest to you that the rest of the dealers throughout the state are not that one dealer. And I don't think we need the additional law and additional regulations because there's been one case that's been brought up in that one dealer.
Mr. Morrison.
Yes.
I would just point out to you that I had a constituent in my own district that went through the damage reconstruction and failure to have properly registered. It wasn't through that particular dealer. So try to narrow it to say that this problem is only an isolated incident. I think it would be very unusual, but not necessarily your one case. I'd put you on notice.
Well, we agree that we need to have something in regulation on it, but it shouldn't be focused just at the auto dealers. It should be focused statewide.
Right. Well, this particular instance, my constituent recovered from the state of Alaska for failure to properly have that, have the proper registration indication.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
I represent Brian.
Where does this fall in under the agreement to purchase an automobile as is, where is? That's done quite a bit. You know, you go into a person, you say, for instance, if I go to a financial institution to repossess a car, they've got a nice automobile and the price seems reasonable, and I come in and say, hey, I'd like to buy your car. And the guy says, okay, I want you to understand it's as is, where is. You buy this thing today, and we're going to tell you what we know, but you're stuck with it. How do we resolve this issue?
We had Charlie Cole do a study for us as part of our educational process on the as-is, where-is program, studying the Magnuson-Moss Act, which is done nationally, and also studying some cases that have been done here locally. One of the difficulties with as-is, where-is is that you remove a vehicle out of as-is, where-is if you sell a service contract with that vehicle. And then there was a lot of discussion and debate whether the service contract was an insurance policy or not an insurance policy and what it implied and what it didn't imply. Through the interpretation that we have, we believe that if a service contract is sold on it, then there are additional implied warranties that go with that. However, if you were to come in and buy a car from me today, and I sold it to you as is, where is, I also must supply a certificate of compliance or certificate of non-compliance for the IM testing. That certificate of compliance is the IM certificate. The certificate of non-compliance, they don't have one, but it has been accepted that the certificate of non-compliance is a certificate that says that the registration is, it's a title-only waiver, which means you have to pull the license plates off. And you get a title only, but you don't get a registration, you don't get license plates on it. And that is the other means for showing the vehicle without the IM test being covered. So the simple, it was sold as is, where is, really doesn't exist anymore. You still must go through all these other hoops to be able to do it. I've even gone as far as putting a notice on my cars. If I have some cars that I'm just going to wholesale, I'll even put a notice, an additional statement on it that says this is sold as salvage, trying to get the point across that this is an old car. This is tired. Yes, it does have problems. Here's the known problems that we know about the car on it. There could be additional problems. It's being sold as salvage. We haven't been challenged on that yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if we weren't challenged at some time that that isn't enough.
Would you be comfortable with the amendment to statutes that makes that reasonable business practice?
Yes, I would. I'd have to see the rest of that and understand that.
Let me interject right here that in as much as I was a proud author of the junk car legislation last time, which at the request of the Wrecker Association or whatever it is here, that you now have a state law that allows you to sell salvage vehicles without having an IM test. And
and thank the chairman for that and the municipality of Anchorage. You know, it's a new law that did pass. I recall the bill number right now. It's involved around junk cars. Passed this last session.
Pardon me?
Right. House Bill 226. Right. There was a special provision in there allowing that activity, so you don't have to have an IM test to sell a car for salvage, but it has to be for salvage purposes. But then, was your statement a little broader than just that?
Well, I'm wondering, you know,
you're talking about the whereas as is.
Yeah, the dealer gets rid of the car to try to reduce the liability as a salvage, but the person who buys it turns around and wants to sell it as a used automobile. Now, the chain of liability is my concern. The fellow made an honest, forthwith effort to know that this is a salvage vehicle. But the person who ultimately buys it comes back and says, oh, you know, this was misrepresented and so forth, I'm going to go to court, and the lawyer comes right back up the line and says, well, you've got the most money, so we're going to nail you. Somewhere along the line, there should be an end to this kind of thing. And I'm just wondering if perhaps this legislation might be, or this proposed changes might be a particular vehicle to establish that, so that we can perhaps circumvent some of these things. You make a good faith effort, hey, it's salvage. You know,
Well, I think it is really necessary to maintain the registration, declaration on the registration. Would you not agree with that, though? That follow the vehicle? I mean, that's really the intent. That protects everybody in the chain of title, I would assume. So that needs to be strengthened.
We suggested one time that for the IM certificates, that rather than doing a registration style of IM certificate, we do a sticker for the window, and which would do a whole bunch of things. One of the problems we have here in Anchorage is we have 3,000 people a day that drive in from the valley and other places to come in and go to work that are not driving IM certified cars. Well, if you had a sticker on the car, you could identify those cars pretty quickly. But we haven't gotten anywhere with that.
Well, they should have their IM tested, but those folks up in the valley would probably have a revolution if we tried to mandate that. Please continue, Mr. Morris.
Okay. We've been working on some recommendations for the committee, specifically on the new and used car disclosures. And we're very close to having those ready to be able to submit. We're not ready as of yet, but we're working very, very closely. We've also invited David Schwartz, the Attorney General's office. We started the original invitation when this bill was first introduced 2 years ago, if he would sit with us and work with us to try to develop something that we could both live with. We've been unable to get together on that yet. I understand that he's looking at joining us here in our next meeting, which is next month's meeting, so that we can again continue to address this and work together with him. We're not an opposition. We are looking for ways to make it easier for the consumer, to make it easier for the business, to make it fair for everybody that's concerned in there. But this issue is so complex that you just can't come in and go, okay, you're going to disclose everything you know about that used car. It doesn't work. That's why no other state in the nation has adopted a used car disclosure law, because it isn't that easy. There's a lot of ramifications to it, and nationally we have a lot of information available to us, and even the national, the attorneys for the national organization would be happy to work on this process in order to be able to help set something up, because it's not just a problem here, it's a problem nationwide. It's just not a simple, easy solution to come in and say, okay, this one stamp's going to cure everything, and work that way. One of the areas that there is already protection, one of the issues that was addressed in some of in the previous hearing was cars that are being sold off the corner that appear to be being sold by a private individual, but are really people that are selling as dealers. We have a dealer licensing and bonding system in the state that is really not being efficiently used. We would be in favor of having some kind of additional legislation or some kind of restriction on the people that are doing that, so that we can work towards beginning more reputable people that are in the business and doing it. The corner guy that's selling out of his backyard does not help our business. And by regulating the business and the way that this bill is talking about isn't going to correct that guy. He's still going to continue to do what he's doing and appear to be a private individual.
Mr. Morrison, on that point, this is the Labor and Commerce Committee, and we handle all the occupational licensing type things. So you indicate you have a dealer licensing law now that you act under, but...
We have a license and bonding. We have to have a dealer license and a bond in order to be able to work with DMV and stock vehicles.
But it's only it's administered through the DMV and not the Department of Commerce, Division of Occupational Licensing?
I should know where it's coming from. I just don't have to pay for it every year.
DMV, right? Okay. So it's not like a typical board where you don't have a regulatory and enforcement statutory capability within your organization under state law to administer any policing, if you will.
No,
or enforcement.
We don't. At this particular point, it's been when there's a problem. We've sat down with different members within our organization and said, you're having a problem in this area. Here's what you can do to straighten it out. And I'm pleased to tell you that the people we've sat down and gone over that with have stepped to and stepped up to the bump and made things right.
Represent Ryan.
Is there a minimum amount of automobile transactions?
Hold on, tape.